We are living through, as you know, due to the Delta variant taking hold in Sydney, about half the Australian population sadly remains in lockdown this weekend. We humans are social creatures, and loneliness and disconnection are raising their distinct heads, beginning to take a toll, together with the memories of previous times. So let's talk about it. I'm happy to welcome Professor Ian Hickey, the Co-Director of Health and Policy at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre, to offer some tips and insights on how to maintain our own personal mental health and, importantly, to talk about a collective well-being. Thank you for joining us, Ian Hickey.
Good morning, Geraldine.
You've said your biggest asset isn't the worth of your house, it's your social network, which is particularly relevant, I'd suggest, Ian, to those who are struggling financially or with work during this lockdown.
Absolutely. I think this week and this weekend of all weekends, rather than asking, are you okay, we have to ask, are we okay? You know, are the social groups that we're in actually responding appropriately and in a supportive way to the disconnection that we're now all experiencing, or at least a large chunk of the country's actually experiencing? And I think we have to move to kind of a serious analysis of that, you know, in our own lives. Are we all keeping it together in a way that is inclusive and helps us all to cope with very challenging circumstances?
Yes. Is there a sort of way to try to think this through a little bit systematically in terms of what sort of friendship group you might need, or what sort of institutional group you might need? Like, is there a concentric circle that is ideal in your view?
The traditional one's gone. Much like the traditional family, the traditional church, the traditional footy club, there are new social structures, and I think people need to think about this a little more carefully. You just raised some important ones like the workplace. I mean, people's most important social relationships and support are actually outside of their family in their work. They may, however, have been connected to other social organisations like churches, footy clubs, sporting clubs, volunteer groups, other common interest groups. Many of those are conducted online these days, and, of course, online right now might be the only way of staying in contact with many of those kind of groups. So people need to stop and think, which are the relationships that are actually most important to me and my group, and how do we maintain those when we're physically disconnected but desperately need to stay emotionally connected?
And I think you've said if you have five friends who can support you and whom you know you're confident of, that's not a bad little rule of thumb. So I presume you can, well, these days we're heading to the phones again rather than just the text line, which is my preferred option. Even though it is changing, what's your instinct about what people almost ought to know is their real good fallback position?
Well, this is really important. People do function in small social groups. We don't really have 600 Facebook friends. We have small social groups that are mutually reinforcing and in connection. And, of course, many are based around traditional family and kin, and we need in a transgenerational way to really attend to that. I mean, some of the people who are going to most struggle at the moment are older people on their own and children and young people disconnected from school and their other social networks. So there's the transgenerational family assets. But I guess I am emphasising those other ones. Those other people that you often share things with, those other people have a perspective about the world that you share that you're in danger of being disconnected from. And, you know, two or three is good, half a dozen, even better. And they're the ones you actually are intimate with, the ones you're quite happy that they comment about you, the ones who, you know, when they ring up and actually want to just share what is happening, you're quite happy to do that with. Now, I think a lot of us don't necessarily value those things as much as we need to, but right now, they're some of our best personal and from a mental health point of view, emotional assets.
So, see, we've really done an enormous amount of focus on this personal, autonomous mental health, haven't we? That's really been, for a generation now, well, maybe more, you can tell me, you know the history of it, the clinical response approach has really looked at the individual. You're saying we've got to reconfigure this a bit?
Yes, there have always been two fundamentals of good mental health. One is personal autonomy. So, in fact, the rise in the status of women, the way the rise of various groups, people being able to act actively in their society and not be held back. So personal autonomy, and that has really dominated individual psychology for the last 40 years, since the late 1970s. But the other is social connection. You cannot actually be well, have a strong sense of well-being, while those around you are actually unwell. And humans are actually much more sensitive to that than they like to pretend. In our current worlds, our Western worlds, I think we have lost a great deal of that, and I worry a moment in Australia we are losing that. I had a conversation with you about a year ago, and you were more sceptical, I think, than I, at how good Australian society would cope with the particular crisis. I was sort of falling back on mateship and volunteering and that kind of sense of nation that we had. I think it's serious. I think you were right. I think it's seriously challenged at the moment, and we're seeing at a national political level the fragmentation of that. I don't think we've yet seen the fragmentation of that at the personal social level, but I think that social connection idea of the 1970s, which is when it sort of peaked in mental health and in psychiatry, in which I worked, has declined since then with this fierce, fierce focus on the individual. Am I okay inside my own head as distinct from is the world I'm in, the social world on which I depend, is it healthy?
Well, this is, I mean, of course, dare I say, this is what the great religions, that they always said this, that it would never be, the individual was never a long-term site for contentment, you know, unless you want to be a hermit sort of thing, that it, you always had to have that business of reaching out, which is quite countercultural, like, you know, even if you think of sort of the yogas and the Pilates of this world, which has taken the place of it. This is a really quite significant reflection of yours.
Oh, look, and I think you raise an important point. You know, I think some of the world's great religions in their implementation have done some things which haven't been great for individual mental health, but the values behind them are quite collectivist. I think you're quite right about that, as are the traditional things of this land. This week I've been doing things with the leaders in the Indigenous world of social and emotional well-being of the group has always been prized by Australian Aboriginals and most traditional collectivist cultures, and absolutely played out in most traditional religions. But beyond the self, the collective well-being is much more important. And one is part of a generation. One is part of, has a cultural identity that goes across generations, is beyond the individual. And I think that is in danger of being lost, and just at the time we most need it, like right now worldwide, but actually in our own backyard, we need that collective value to operate. It's very interesting in the public health discussions you were having, the use of the word I continuously, the personal pronoun, I need you to do this or you should do that. You almost never hear any of our latest leaders at the moment say, what do we need to do? What is the common value? How do we respond? Rather finger pointing at southwestern Sydney or Bondi or the glow crop the borders or who caused the problem, rather than what are we going to do? You know, and the mobilisation of the we, the common value, is what public health is actually all about.
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, and the challenge here is that, like, if you think about bushfires, where we are frankly magnificent, people are invited to do something. Here, we're invited to withdraw. In fact, the virtuous thing to do is to withdraw and to go inward. I mean, certainly at the moment, this is really tough, I think, for people. So it does fundamentally go against, this is what's so challenging and has been throughout history, I might add, of plagues.
Yes, yeah, so there's a key point that you're raising, because that sort of crisis response to a bushfire, an earthquake, a drought, people can come together. And Australian communities have done that fabulously, and they still do. Whenever there's one of those really big crises, people come together and take collective action. They don't need to be told what to do by premiers or politicians or by law enforcement. They act collectively. It's very hard to do that. But I think that's the challenge, in fact, in communication and in these areas. What are the collective actions? Not only that they're effective from a public health point of view, but actually from a mental health point of view, our community increases the strength of its social fabric, which is that second arm of really good mental health, social connection along with personal autonomy.
Living with uncertainty seems to be emerging as a really critical factor. I mean, we think, you know, we're constantly peppering ourselves saying we live in such disruptive times and there's been so volatile, you know, and nothing like this since the Victorian era. But really, don't you think what's emerged is that in many ways lives in the developed world, in the West, are really immensely routinized and safe, somewhat banal, some people would say, because there's the risk is relatively low for a lot of people. So maybe there hasn't been a lot of practice at this sort of, it is about keeping calm and carrying on. Talked about this in previous Saturday Extras. So how do you think people can manage this or skill themselves up?
Look, I think it's an important issue you raised, the uncertainty issue. Humans don't cope well with uncertainty. And they don't cope well with what they feel isn't transparent, in the Australian context, transparent information either. You know, in the current lockdowns, if people said, look, we're going to be locked down for 6 weeks, that's the reality, okay? Let's adapt. you're going to have to make changes. You can make plans. You can respond. I think it is also true what you say. We've through an incredibly stable period in the Western world that we haven't had to respond collectively for a very long time, some would argue since the end of the Second World War, really. And that reliance, that need to have a collective action, the importance of that has not been evident to young people, to many other people who've never lived through a crisis in a particular way. So I think that is an important issue you raise, is uncertainty. Life is uncertain and then you die. You know, that is the nature of actually the processes that we have. So the issue is not that there's going to be or that politicians can provide certainty or that anyone with regards to the coronavirus can provide certainty about what happens next. What you need are the tools to actually deal with the adaptation we have to make. They're personal tools in how we live our lives, but they're also collective or social tools, small group tools. How does our family, how does our workplace, how does our local suburb, and then at another level, how does our nation state actually deal with the realities of having to respond and be reactive? The comment you made before, we need politicians that react to what the truth is today. The medical situation has changed radically over the last 18 months. There's new information every week. And undoubtedly, the pandemic has some time to run yet. So the notion that anyone could have ever been certain or ever known the right answer is this thing from, you know, this is what we're dealing with now. Do we have the tools to respond? And in that sense, Geraldine, your point's a very good one. That keeps actual anxiety down, not up.
Well, there are a couple of, you know, I think you said to our producer, we need to live each day ourselves in a reliable way, which I think is a very interesting way of putting it and quite calming because it's your own reliability, no one else's. And there's another sort of hint that I heard somebody say is, if you really are beset with massive anxiety, set aside an hour to worry. This might sound silly, but it is a device. Set aside an hour when you know you will or whatever, and then get on with life. I mean, these are the little tips I think people are seeking.
Yes, so at a personal level, we all live in 24-hour cycles, the day-night cycle, our circadian clock, our body clock. And during that particular time, you need to live each day as it is. Now, part of that is you need to not live on the edge of your nerves the whole 24 hours, go to sleep and wake up just as anxious as you were yesterday. That doesn't work. And whether you take an hour of worry, as you suggested, or you take an hour of exercise, which much people would prefer, or an hour of meditation or time out of the news cycle, out of the arousal cycle, to say, no, wait a minute, this is going to go on for a lot of time. I've got to live each day. Now, normally, of course, through work, through school, through routines, we've got that built in. At the moment, it requires a little more self-discipline to put that back in or within your family or within your group to go, you know what, this is a day by day. We need to live each day in a way, as some would say, it's often used in the cancer world, live each day authentically. You know, that today matters. What am I going to do today? I will focus on the news. I need to know what the virus is doing. That can be the worry bit. But I also need to enjoy something. I need to actually achieve something. I need to have some purposeful actions each day and not get into a total, you know, panic over whether this lasts 2 weeks, 6 weeks or 3 months. You know, the authenticness of everyday life, and I would say the importance of social relationships within that is the things that really matter, are some of the things we need to attend to.
Is the media cycle and the daily numbers at press conferences and the conduct of this contributing, do you think, to people's anxiety and maybe depression?
Yes. Bottom line is, do you really have to tune in at 11 o'clock on the dot every day? Maybe if you're employed in the media, you do. Do we really have to have a long, drawn-out kind of process and an examination, you know, going through the entrails of every single bit? I mean, I think at a political level, that's been a mistake. And I think at a media level in the world we live in, of course, in this sort of 24-hour news, cable television world we're in, that's a danger. It does not help people's mental health. People, in fact, need to back off from that and go, you know what, that's just one piece of information I need to know. But there are many other things to be done rather than to be at the edge of the old wireless or the TV listening to what happens next. It's not going to make a tremendous amount of difference what the number is today or tomorrow. And I think the political management of this could learn a lot from actually just being straightforward and honest and direct every day what the situation is and what will be the numbers or the situation that would cause a significant change so that people can live their daily lives in a more normal way and focus on purposeful activities, focus on connection, focus on those things that in our life really do matter in the longer term. not just the crisis or the political drama of the day.
One of our texters has said, it takes a village to bring up a child, as we've heard this great phrase. Where are the modern villages? You know, are they languishing?
Well, this is, I think, one of the most important things to emerge. And one of the things I'm personally tied up at the moment in is that, in fact, in a podcast I'm doing with James O'Loughlin at the moment on the ABC, is entirely devoted at the moment, can you rebuild the village? And in my view, yes. I mean, you sit in urban planning in Sydney where Clover Moore, the Lord Mayor, talks about rebuilding villages within the city of Sydney. You see within communities the need to create new structures that are transgenerational, you know, have grandparents interacting with grandchildren in everyday life. We actually got to refine some of those or find new ways. People are using technology to invent new ways of actually maintaining or supporting those particular networks. So I think in the West, for the reasons you alluded to earlier, over a 50-year period, we've let those things decline as we no longer participate so actively in churches, community groups, sporting groups, things in our local neighbourhood, and say, actually, you know what? We really need those for effective aged care, for effective child rearing, and right now for all of us to actually cope with the mental health demands of the current degree of physical disconnection and disruption of our normal daily routines.
I must say, we've got a lovely text here from a Melburnian. I wholeheartedly agree with your discussion. There was an enormous sense of the collective after the Melbourne lockdown last year. We felt that sense of togetherness. This reaction from you both is what we all learned in Melbourne last year. And then another man has said, keep calm and carry on is absolutely not what needs to occur at this point in time. Keep calm, yes. Carry on, no. COVID makes a mockery of a stiff upper lip.
That's a good point, Jeremy. I'm not suggesting there's a stiff upper lip. I'm just suggesting taking active actions to express what's going on. What we're talking about at the moment, I think in Australia there's been a good discussion that mental health is one of the really serious impacts. So we're not denying it. We're not suppressing it. We're actually talking about it. But it's having tools to cope with it. It's what you do about it rather than just be affected by it. The stiff upper lip, the English idea, is you're actually affected by it a lot, but nobody knows, and then terrible things happen. We're talking about the act. Personal and social actions that recognise the distress it is causing.
Very interesting. Thank you, Ian Hickey, for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Geraldine.
And Ian Hickey doing that podcast is called Minding the Mind, by the way, with James O'Loughlin, which is where I first heard him speaking like this, being very specific, and I thought, right, we'll have him on. So thank you for all your feedback too.